The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, November 22nd, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, folks. Oh, I'm with you right now. But not really. I'm actually in the future. No, scratch. I'm in the past. You're in the future. I'm talking to you in the future. I don't know why I always make such a big deal of this, because of the vast majority of you, I'm always doing that every day because you're listening as a podcast. But if you're listening live, which is impossible, then I'm talking to you from the past. How's the future? Is it great? Are you headed towards home for Thanksgiving? I am. I'm headed there right now. My kids are, of course, complaining in the car. Everyone around me is complaining. I'm complaining. I'm future complaining. I'm preemptively complaining about the complaints that I'm hearing. But one thing, I want to reach back into the past. If you recall, on Tuesday, which is yesterday, if you're listening to this today, but if you're really listening to this today, which is impossible, you'd know this is actually still Tuesday. Nevertheless, on Tuesday's show, Jamie did not have the opportunity to say what her sort of unique, I guess it was, Thanksgiving food was, right? Is that what the question was we got from an IMer?
Yep.
And so you've been fuming about this.
I was writing down timestamps at the time.
There was a lot of angst in the office after the show that Jamie did not get to say what it was. And so this is going to come as a surprise to me as well as to you. What is that food, Jamie?
Well, I want to brag about it because I'm really proud of myself, because everyone's always really impressed by it.
Do you want a drum roll for this?
No, it's okay. I was vegetarian for many years and vegan for many years after that, and I'm still mostly vegan. I just eat occasional eggs and seafood. So I like to make a seitan roast from scratch with mushroom stuffing and vegan gravy.
Wait, like a roast? Like, how big is this? I always imagined seitan to be, well, I guess it comes in like big squares, doesn't it?
Well, if you make it yourself, you can put it in whatever shape you want.
Oh, I had no idea. So you made a homemade seitan.
Yes, it's the recipe I got from Post Punk Kitchen. Shout out to them. And it's a real crowd pleaser, assuming your crowd is open-minded about these things.
Does that mean don't really care about taste?
No.
I'm just asking. I mean,
delicious
dishes, I like seitan.
And the mixture of flavorings you put in there is also really good. My brother-in-law, who is a total meat eater, said that it tastes like a good brat because I put some caraway seeds, crush them up.
All right. Very, very good. So how long does it take to make?
That's a good question. Maybe like an hour, and then another hour when it's like in the oven.
So it's conceivable all right, well, let's put it this way. If there's anybody who hears this on Wednesday and they end up making it for Thanksgiving holiday, report back.
That would be so good. Shout out to all my vegans and vegetarians also. Like, I know it's a difficult holiday for you guys, and I just want to say, like, props. Don't be mean to your relatives. Just, like, lead by example. Make something delicious, and they will flock to you.
Maybe.
If you're lucky.
My experience is maybe that will happen. Hey, just a reminder, folks, support for today's show comes from Health IQ. Health IQ believes that the best way to improve the health of the world is to celebrate the health conscious through social and financial rewards. They use science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health conscious people, including runners, cyclists. You ready for this? Jamie, strength trainers, but vegans and more. So you actually, this is brilliant. You actually get rewarded. I mean, they say being vegan is much healthier for you. And this Health IQ helps customers save between 4 to 33% on their life insurance. And these are savings that are exclusive to Health IQ. 56% of Health IQ customers say they save between 4 and 33% on their life insurance because they live a more healthy lifestyle. I don't know that I would have been eligible for this back in the day when I got my health insurance, because I was still within the sort of had smoke cigarettes realm within my 5-year thing or whatever it was. But like saving money by being a good driver, Health IQ gets you lower rates on life insurance for living a health conscious lifestyle. Physically active people have a 34% lower risk of all-cause mortality, a 56% lower risk of heart disease, and a 22% decrease in cancer mortality compared to people who remain inactive. I guess this is the they cite this Warburton et al., the CMGA. That must be the something CMA journal, would be my guess, in 2006. But to see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/majority. That's healthiq.com/majority to get your free quote.
I might just do that.
There you go. You should. I mean, if you're still going vegan, what are you doing? You're vegetarian, right, now?
I'm a pescatarian. I'm mostly vegan.
Pescatarian. I feel like that's the one that I'm closest to, because we've basically knocked out a lot of our meat consumption.
That's good.
But I eat fish and eggs. I don't, the whole egg thing I don't get.
I don't do dairy. It fucks with my stomach.
Yeah, but that's not, that's more, that's just like, I don't know. I don't eat, well, I guess I'd eat everything. So, folks, on the program today, we have Christopher Glazik. He is the writer who wrote the piece, The Secret of Family, Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis. If you have not listened to the 2 days that I was in Vegas for the Tort Lawyer Conference, you will find 2 interviews there, one with Peter Mouget, one with Burton LeBlanc, who talk about the lawsuits that they are part of against the distributor of particularly OxyContin, but other opioids. There's some statutory obligations that these distributors had that they failed to live up to. But before it gets to the distributor, there's a company that made this stuff. And this is one of those classic stories. I don't know if these people are as eligible to be sued as the distributors. But this is a classic story of the just deep desire for as much money as possible and externalizing the costs of those pursuit of profits by a family that now has made billions of dollars on this. Really selling, in many respects, poison. And it wasn't as if these people had some type of new wonder drug. They really argued that they had a new wonder delivery mechanism for a drug that didn't turn out to be so wonderful. Christopher Glazik, writing in Esquire magazine, The Secret of Family, Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis. Also, Matt has some Matt picks, deep archive picks from our deep archive.
We have Sam talking to Bernie about the estate tax in 2006.
What? What's old is new, folks. What's old is new. And some of it is still old. I'm older and Bernie's older. We're both older. But so if you're a member, you will get that as a bonus material today. And a reminder, if you want to become a member, just become a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com right now and join the Majority Report. You will have a chance to, even if you haven't become a member, you join and then you go back and you listen to the archive show, would it be yesterday's show or today's show, and you listen to that Bernie Sanders interview. That's our way of saying thank you for supporting the show. Also, don't forget, MR Holiday is the coupon code for justcoffee.coop, 30% off, free shipping. Try out all their blends. Finally, try the Majority Report blend. You will not regret it. Okay, take a quick break, then we'll be back with Chris Glazik, secretive family making billions from the opioid crisis. Make sure you tune in Friday, too, folks. We got William Hoagland. It's a fascinating story about the development of not just America's standing army, but really, I think one could argue this is sort of the, I don't know how to put this, but...
baby steps of empire?
Yes. And the sort of ground zero for imperialism, the imperialism ethos in American culture. Quick break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Christopher Glazik. He is a contributing writer to Esquire magazine, has written in numerous publications, including The New Yorker, and has written in this month's edition of Esquire, The Secret of Family Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, you know, we've on this program, we've talked a decent amount of the opioid crisis. I've sat down with lawyers who are bringing cases against the distributors, particularly of OxyContin, trying to get compensation for cities and states that have had to pay out public funds to deal with this massive crisis that we're dealing with. And you could maybe give us a little bit of statistics as to just how wide-ranging the opioid crisis is. But you've done an in-depth look at the family behind the company, Purdue, that has produced OxyContin. What was it? I mean, how hard? Let's just start with this. I mean, tell us who the family was, or is, I guess.
Right. So the Sackler family is a family of billionaires from New York City. The family started as three brothers who were born in Brooklyn in the 19-teens. And the patriarch of the family, Arthur Sackler, got his start in pharmaceutical advertising in the 40s and 50s. And he was actually a major innovator in the field of medical and pharmaceutical advertising. So, you know, when he kind of emerged on the scene at that time, all there was door-to-door salesmen called detail men. So the pharma companies would kind of send these reps door-to-door to doctors to kind of try to sell drugs to them, and that still happens too. But Arthur's big insight was that you could use print advertising in medical journals to reach a much larger number of doctors more efficiently. And so he was actually the first person to get the Journal of the American Medical Association to include a color insert for a pharmaceutical drug.
Well, let's just stop there for a moment, because it is obviously, you know, you can look at the numbers and you can say, okay, there's a higher yield, right? Whatever the ratio is of people who will see those eyeballs and actually can, if not necessarily purchase, but prescribe his product, right? There's a lot of value there too. But I also would imagine that when you are advertising in a medical journal, that there's some other level of cachet, that there is almost like an implicit sense that, like, yeah, this is for real.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's channeling the authority of the medical journal to lend it this, you know, kind of scientific aura. And that's something that Sacklers have done again and again with tremendous success. You know, you could call it white coat washing. You know, they kind of present business objectives as medical objectives, and then they're able to kind of launder, their companies and their family's reputation through the prestige of the medical profession.
I want to continue on with you telling us more about the Sacklers, but I want to circle back at one point to this whole story is, you know, basically comes down to an enormous amount of greed and just a failure of either the existence of safeguards or the failure of safeguards that are just simply not adequate enough to address and to mitigate this greed.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the Sacklers have had some help along the way. You know, some of the biggest help they got was actually from the FDA, which made a number of mistakes in approving the original application for OxyContin.
All right. Well, we'll get to the FDA in a second. So tell us more about these three brothers. One of them, Arthur, was an advertising whiz. The other two were doctors.
Well, so they were all trained psychiatrists, actually. They're MDs, and they were interested in psychiatry, and actually did a bunch of research into on the human brain. And the research was actually quite promising, and they were the first, for instance, to isolate cortisol as a kind of psychoactive substance. And you know, at the time when they were doing their research, psychiatry was totally dominated by Freudians who weren't interested in the kind of biochemical explanations. So their work was kind of considered fringe. But you know, they were real research scientists. Arthur was really the patriarch of the family, and he would often kind of find jobs for his younger siblings to take over. He was the one who coordinated the purchase of Purdue Pharma in 1952, but he actually had his brothers run it instead of him. Because he was a medical advertiser, it would have been a conflict of interest if he also had his own pharmaceutical company. But so he kind of, he owned several companies secretly and would often have other people run them for him. But, you know, his brothers were kind of his understudies.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so... So they, Purdue, like, what did they make leading up to, why don't you explain how they came upon the idea of OxyContin and the idea of Contin?
Sure. Okay. Well, so useful to note that the family's first really big influx of cash, we think, came in the 1960s because Arthur Sackler was the first one to, was the one who devised the advertising strategy for Valium. And he was, and Valium was manufactured by Roche, a pharmaceutical company, but Arthur was the ad man behind it, and he was compensated in terms of volume of pills sold. And what he did he pulled off a pretty remarkable trick. So Roche already had a benzo on the market called Librium, which is, you know, virtually indistinguishable from Valium. Valium then was released under a different name, a slightly different dose, but it was marketed in a very different way. Librium had been targeted narrowly, for what at the time was called anxiety issues, although anxiety at the time wasn't quite the buzzword that it is now. But what Arthur did for Valium is he said, hey, there's all these other kinds of problems that people have, these physical somatic problems. They have headaches, they have trouble sleeping, indigestion, sexual problems. So he kind of invented this other concept called psychic tension, which they asserted was at the root of many of these physical problems. And the conclusion being that you could take a Valium pill to help with all these different kinds of physical problems you might have, because really what was causing the physical problem was psychic tension. So in this way, he made Valium the most widely prescribed drug in the United States and was the first drug ever to reach more than $100 million in sales.
Now, all right, this is a moment, I think, where people get sort of like surprised, where you can create an affliction and remarket an existing drug. And the FDA it's all fine with
the
FDA.
This was the early 60s, remember, so there were not the same kind of safeguards in place and not the same degree of regulation of drugs that there is now. But, you know, even today, companies are given wide latitude with a lot of this stuff. And, and crucially, what the Sacklers ended up doing with OxyContin was actually extremely similar to what they did, what they had done with Valium earlier on.
All right. Well, tell us what kind of safeguards were available in the 60s. I mean, and then let's just compare it to where we are today to a certain extent, because, was there any restrictions on this at this time?
So, there was actually, there was movement in the 60s to introduce more restrictive regimes, and there were these Senate hearings that Arthur Sackler actually had to testify before. And one of the things they were really worried about in the 50s, and Sackler was involved in this also, was with the overprescription of antibiotics. So these new antibiotics were coming on the market, and the companies were trying to sell them for, you know, all kinds of different conditions, but it was actually, they were worried about breeding antibiotic resistance, which we're still worried about today. In terms of the exact timing of some of these pharmaceutical reforms, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it would have been not been until the 70s that some more restrictions were put on the claims that pharmaceutical advertisers could make. But certainly, yeah, in the 60s, there was not the same kind of restrictive regime. Today, you know, the FDA allows pharmaceutical companies to make certain kinds of claims about their drugs, and then there's claims that they're not allowed to make. They're not allowed to exceed what the FDA label says, with some asterisks.
Right, and those asterisks very often lead to some pretty crazy and horrific outcomes, as like these drug companies, try and push off-label prescribing for these drugs, but they do it in a sort of much quieter way. All right, so Sackler was innovative in that he had basically taking a bunch of pre-existing, I guess, states of being, bundled it up into a name that sounded like it was an official psychological problem, neurological problem, and a marketed value made it the highest grossing. I mean, can you still make deals like that today with your advertisers? Like, we're going to give you a commission? That seems to be bad.
It was very innovative at the time. I'm not sure exactly how those contracts are typically structured today, but I think that there are performance benchmarks that you're supposed to meet.
That to me seems really contrary to the Hippocratic oath.
Well, so it makes everything a volume game, and it makes pharmaceutical companies and their advertisers, their number one priority is just maximizing volume, and that has everything to do with the opioid crisis. And people can kind of debate like what the best approach to regulating dangerous drugs is, and we have some people who advocate these very restrictive prohibition regimes, and other people think that drug use should be decriminalized. One thing that's worth looking at though is that we have had this kind of controlled experiment with relatively unfettered, profit-driven, almost free market in prescription opioids, and when you attach a huge profit motive to that, you're inevitably going to get the volume going up and up and up, and that's what's happened.
All right, so Sackler is one of the first inductees into the Medical Advertising Hall of Fame.
That's right.
And those words also, I don't know, I find troubling, frankly. and so they're very wealthy, prior to OxyContin. They're a very wealthy family. They own just Purdue and then another drug company in the UK, or is this all part of Purdue, or what's the relationship between those companies?
Yeah, they talk about it as a family of companies, but yeah, there's related companies in the UK. Knapp Pharmaceutical was their big British wing. And today, there's literally hundreds of foreign entities that are all kind of connected to the Purdue family, but they're not technically subsidiaries of Purdue, but they're all owned 100% by the Sacklers.
I also appreciated...
I think they're all 100%. I should say I'm not positive they're all 100%.
I appreciated the stories you told of Arthur Sackler's charitable giving to local museums in New York, because it gives a sense of just sort of, there's a certain mentality here, I think, that has to exist, right? As, if you're going to sell this stuff and have some awareness, and we'll get into, what awareness the Sacklers had, and Arthur, of course, was dead at that time. But if you're going to push volume, let's say, and sell it based upon, it's not outright fabrications, but just sort of like a very... a nuanced version of a fabrication, I guess, watching what he did with his tax deductions, his charitable giving. Just tell us a couple of stories or one that you cite in the piece from the Met.
Right. The Met was – so Arthur Sackler, starting in the 50s, became an art collector, and he pretty quickly amassed the world's most significant collection of ancient Chinese artifacts. He kind of brought his acquisitive instincts to the art market and was kind of a master acquiring new stuff and kind of cornering the market. And so museums were always really anxious to bag him as a donor, and the Met was kind of repeatedly trying to get him to donate money to the Met and to donate some of his collection. But Arthur kept imposing these really onerous terms. So the first donation he made, which is in 1963, he agreed to give, I think it was, you know, it was $150,000 or something. At that time, that was, you know, worth much more. But he required as a condition that the Met first sell to him a huge quantity of artifacts, but at the original 1920s prices for which they had been bought. Then Arthur would donate back the very same artifacts to the Met, but he would take a tax deduction based on their current prices. So, in effect, he was able to take a tax deduction that was so large that it was larger than the total value of his donation, most likely. That was one thing. Another time when he gave money, he insisted that the Met make available to him this large cavern in the museum for him to store his own private collection, which saved him insurance costs and fire costs and all this stuff. So he had basically, there was a secret room in the Met to house Arthur Sackler's collection. And the Met was, you know, convinced, like, well, you know, eventually he'll just donate this stuff to the Met. So, you know, we're willing to play this game where we let him house it for free in our museum for a number of years. And it actually ended up triggering an attorney general's investigation, saying this was a misuse of public funds. You can't, you know, benefit this individual by allowing him to have his private collection in the museum. But eventually, Arthur got mad at the Met. They wouldn't give him a seat on the board. He was mad that there's all these homosexuals on staff. And he had a couple other misgivings about the way that his donations were being used. So he actually ended up donating almost all that stuff to the Smithsonian in Washington. So he kind of screwed the Met in the end.
How did that attorney general investigation work out? I mean, it seems to me that the Met was engaged in sort of that sounds a little bit illicit to me, too.
So they did not find any wrongdoing on the part of Arthur, but they did reprimand the Met.
All right, fair enough. But we get a sense of just his sort of, I guess, his perspective on society at large. So Arthur dies, and then his brothers buy his share in Purdue. When does that happen relative to OxyContin? Tell us, or start with the idea, the concept of Contin for us,
right,
and then we'll work.
Okay. So it's important to note that Purdue, you know, which they bought in 1952, was this really small, insignificant pharmaceutical company for years and years. It was kind of a midget in the industry, and they had a number of products, didn't really have any big hits. Their first big hit was actually they acquired the rights to Betadine, which is this antiseptic. And they had really good timing because they bought it just as the Vietnam War was ramping up. And so the U.S. government bought tons of Betadine to heal soldiers' wounds in Vietnam. But they didn't hit it big until they entered the pain business. And the way they got there was they had developed this time-released asthma medication that didn't really take off. But according to the company lore, there was a doctor in London who worked for this hospice. It was actually kind of the world's first hospice. And he was aware of this time-release asthma medication, and he suggested to the Sackler's company there that they create a time-release morphine pill. And this would be great for the hospice, he said, because it would allow dying cancer patients to sleep through the night without an IV. As it was at the time, they could take morphine, but they would have to take it, you know, in pretty constant increments. So if they could take a pill that was long-acting, it lasted 8 or 12 hours, then that would help people sleep. And so they took this advice, and they did create a time-release morphine medication called MS-Contin. Contin means continuous, and that refers to the time-release system that they developed. So MS-Contin became a hit in the cancer market, and it sold quite well in that small niche, and it brought a lot of prestige to Purdue as a company, which hadn't really had anything really successful before. So all of a sudden, they were involved in this really holy work of relieving the pain of dying cancer patients, allowing them to die with dignity, to sleep through the night. And so this really put Purdue on the map. One of the problems with MS-Contin, though, is that its patent was going to expire in the 90s, and they didn't have anything to replace it. And so people at the company, and it was kind of around this time that the next generation started asserting control. This would have been Arthur's nephew, Richard Sackler. who really starts adopting a more important role in the company in the 80s. And they get the idea, what if we created a new time-release opioid, but instead of time-release morphine, what if we make it time-release oxycodone? And oxycodone was kind of a dusty old chemical. It had been around since the 20s, but it had a number of advantages over morphine. The most important one was that it was perceived by doctors as much weaker than morphine. And the reason for that was that it was in Percocet and Percodan, which are these relatively weak combination opioids that people take for injuries and stuff like that. Morphine had this really kind of serious, kind of, you know, funereal reputation. People were like, oh, my God, if I'm on morphine, that means I'm about to die. You couldn't get ordinary doctors to prescribe morphine. I mean, most never had. That was only something for, you know, cancer doctors. But ordinary doctors were very familiar with oxycodone because they prescribed it all the time in the form of Percocet. So, you know, and the company, you know, has acknowledged this in lawsuits, and I talked to employees about this. They played on this misconception that oxycodone was weak. In fact, oxycodone is even stronger than morphine on a milligram for milligram basis. But they, you know, they released OxyContin as kind of a successor product to MS Cotton, and it had immediately this kind of brand identity in doctors' minds that this was not as serious, that this was not as strong as MS Cotton, when in fact it was just as strong.
That's interesting. All right, so just to be clear, the this was an active ingredient in Percocet that just because of the amount that was in Percocet made it less powerful. But
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you had a very small dose in Percocet. You know, you like 5 milligrams usually, but with OxyContin, they released pills that were 20, 30, 40, even 80 milligrams of oxycodone in a single pill. You know, so that's like basically, you know, I mean, that's 15 times as strong as it is a Percocet.
Tell the story of the doctors from Sloan Kettering in 1986, because this is something that I've also heard, that to the extent that there was any data points, I guess, that the OxyContin would be less addictive than Oxy, I guess, a similar opioid. It came from these two doctors I guess it's a study.
Okay, so there's a couple things that happened. The research that happened in the 80s, and there's a couple of kind of pivotal but kind of paltry little contributions to the literature that got cited again and again and again and kind of blown out of proportion. But that was not specifically comparing oxycodone to morphine or anything like that. That was just asserting that opioids in general, were safe and effective for chronic pain. And there was kind of notoriously a letter to the editor that was written the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980, which asserted that the risk of addiction was less than 1%. But it was based on this like really small, unrepresentative cohort. And in fact, some of them had become addicted, and it was this whole kind of messy thing. The authors of that letter to the editor ended up renouncing it later. But in the meantime, the pharmaceutical companies got a hold of that. And then there were two doctors in New York, Kathleen Foley and David Portnoy, or sorry, Russell Portnoy. They published another study in 1986, which similarly concluded that long-term opioids were safe and effective treatment for chronic pain. So, you know, you have a kind of a couple things happening in succession. You have the hospice movement, which really takes off in the 70s. Then you have the palliative care movement, which is related. So you're getting doctors, you know, more and more used to prescribing powerful opioids in certain situations. But then you have these patient groups and a couple doctors associated with them that want to push further. And they say, hey, these are so effective for palliative care. Why don't we use these strong opioids for all kinds of problems? And that's when the pharmaceutical companies really saw the opportunity, because they say, hey, this drug that we've been just targeting at the cancer market, why don't we target it at 30 million back pain patients? Why don't we target it at millions of people who have, you know, neuropathic pain? Why don't we target it at people with menstrual pain? You know, they target it at OBGYNs or at dentists to give to people with toothaches. And that's kind of taking Arthur Sackler's original insight with Valium. You have this addictive substance. At first, it's narrowly targeted, But what if you can just take that and then market it to a huge universe of patients, then you're really in the money.
And we should say that those two doctors, their study was of 38 people, which is
right.
not exhaustive by any means. But the amazing thing is that's all it took. Like it just it seems like there was a combination of three things. One is just a basic misunderstanding of the power of this drug. Two, the scant research across the board so that you had outsized impact from what little there was. And three ends up being also just sort of like people not knowing the difference between oxycodone and OxyContin.
That's right. Yeah. What you want to look at when you look at, these big social problems, we're encouraged to think of them as the result of these large impersonal forces that are really hard to understand and take place slowly over time. And, that's true to some extent, but that can distract from the fact that a lot of big social problems have their root in actions taken by individuals. And so when you're looking at something as complex as the opioid epidemic, you want to look at, who is benefiting most, who had the most aerial view of everything that was going on, who was able to manipulate, the other events that were taking place in order to maximize their own profits. And in looking at that, you really end up inevitably going back to the manufacturer, which is Purdue Pharma.
And what,
incidentally, which had much more knowledge about what was going on than the distributors did, which are kind of comparatively really bit players in this drama.
Well, all right, let's talk about what they know, because my understanding of the distributors, the reason why we're going to see a lot of litigation is that, they had a statutory requirement to address any, large blips in the prescribing and delivery, essentially, of medications to specific areas. And so after the first year, they may not have known the details of the problems with OxyContin, but they just knew from a sheer sort of trajectory, like, hey, something's going on here. And yet they had very, they had a statutory obligation according to the, via the DEA. That's what we heard about a couple of weeks ago when we heard that there were congresspeople and there was a nominee who was pushing changing that statutory obligation. But so what did Purdue know? Like, what did these guys know?
Well, this is really key because they knew much, much more than the distributors did. I mean, the distributors basically just take the pills from the manufacturer and deliver them to the pharmacy.
Right. So the distributors only had models of, we should be selling X amount of these pills in these locations on any given day. The pills could be anything. The only thing that they're measuring is actually just sheer numbers. That's the only data
they don't know. They don't know if there's a pain clinic in that town or there's a hospital nearby. I think that they made some mistakes, and I think that they should be held liable for those. But but it's important though to understand that what Purdue had access to was much more granular data. They had access to data down to the prescription level through this company IMS, which is a prescription data mining company. They had a they were able to see which doctors were prescribing what amounts in what areas. And Purdue actually kept a list internally of doctors they suspected of running pill mills, and they did not share that list with law enforcement for many years.
Wow. All right.
The manufacturers could only see one part of the chain. Purdue could see every step in the chain.
All right. Well, let's start, though, before we get to the actual distribution and this the idea that they're pill mills. But what did they know about their actual product that they were selling? I mean, it's one thing to say like, we're playing off of misunderstanding by doctors. We're playing off of misunderstandings by the general public. We understand this is a powerful thing. But we've had these two doctors who studied 38 people and it's fine. But did they have reason to believe provable reason to believe that this stuff was so dangerous?
Well, they had conducted studies, internally that suggested addiction rates much, much higher than 1%, as much as 12 or 13%, and they kind of tried to downplay those findings or suppress them in a way. Did they know that they were creating, a generation of addicts? I haven't seen the kind of smoking gun with respect to that, although I think some people are looking for it. They certainly had reason to believe that these statistics they were citing, saying that like the risk of addiction is less than 1%. I mean, that was plainly ridiculous.
And so, okay, so now let's get to that part about the, at what point did they start to, keep these records about these pill mills? That's incredible.
Right. So this was uncovered during an excellent Los Angeles Times investigation that was published last year in 2016. And that was kind of, looking at that was part of my inspiration for looking into the family. They basically had lists of doctors that were prescribing suspiciously high amounts of the maximum dosage pills, which were the 80 milligram pills. And they did not share that list with law enforcement. But basically, they discouraged sales reps from communicating with those doctors. And sales reps, I think, actually did not get a bonus for selling to those doctors because those doctors were already selling so much they didn't need any encouragement.
Was that a cost savings thing or was that a liability saving thing? Like, I mean, were they basically saying like, we don't need you to push it there and we're not going to give you, you're not going to get the sales bonus. It's unfair that you have a pill mill there. You can't do that to get your trip to the Bahamas or whatnot because, Fred doesn't have one in his district.
And sales reps would complain about that a lot, actually. You're saying, or was it?
Or was
a
it like
issue?
A tacit admission that like, let's not be aware of what's going on in door number three.
Right. So, I'm not sure that I don't know that I can answer that question because I've heard different things. The sales reps definitely are of the view that the system was designed merely to deny them bonuses. So they think that this is just an excuse for the company to stiff the sales reps, like, and not compensate them for doctors who's writing a huge number of prescriptions in their district. But it also changes at different points. So in the beginning, they didn't have this system in place, and sales reps who did have pill mills in their district were getting huge bonuses, and that caused a lot of bitterness too because not every sales rep did have a pill mill in their district. Whether the company's motivations were for keeping that list, I'm not sure that's been settled, and I think that's the subject of some litigation.
What were the statutory requirements, and what are the statutory requirements? What are the FDA requirements of a company that produces drugs, and then B, like, I mean, it seems to me like they could say, like, yeah, that we just kept those documents about the pill mills for internal reasons. It's not fair to our other salespeople that, if we're selling candy to have, one guy who has all of the elementary schools in his. What statutory obligations do they have as manufacturers of the pills?
Well, I mean, this is part of the problem with the FDA process is that once the FDA approves a drug, it's generally been held that manufacturers have very little responsibility. So you can compare it to something like, Takata airbags or whatever. So Takata is a Japanese company that created these faulty airbags, and it's the biggest airbag company in the world. And the patriarch of the family, Mr. Takata, he had to resign, and the company basically went bankrupt in the last couple of years because their airbags killed like a couple people. I mean, really, it was like less than 20 people or something like that. But they had to give this big press conference, and the patriarch of the family had to apologize and bowed his head in silence for a couple minutes, and he kind of fell on his sword in this dramatic fashion. And when you compare the harm caused by these airbags, the harm caused by Oxycontin, I mean, it's laughable. Oxycontin is, thousands of times as deadly. But because it's an FDA-regulated and approved drug, that has made it difficult to go after the manufacturer, and you really have to demonstrate, some real deviousness in order to do that. People are asserting that now, though, and are going after them.
That they were hiding information that they knew and misrepresenting, willfully misrepresenting, that type of thing.
Yeah, there's many different issues that are being looked at. It should be noted, though, that, I mean, so Purdue in 2007 did have to agree to plead guilty to criminal charges. And three of its top executives actually also had to plead guilty to criminal charges, and the company had to pay $600 million. The executives had to pay like 30-some million out of their own pockets. This was an enormous settlement at the time in 2007, and very, very rare for a company and its executives to plead guilty to criminal charges, you know, not just civil charges. And so at the time, this was considered to be a great victory for the government. But, you know, there's a couple, couple footnotes there. One is that at that time, it was not known exactly how deadly and catastrophic the opioid epidemic would become. And secondly, even though it looked like the top people in the company all went down, because it was the CEO, the chief medical officer, and the general counsel, the family members who owned the company and who filled more than half of the board seats and who actually supplied the company's top executives, they were mentioned nowhere in the settlement. And the guy who went down, who was the CEO, he had actually recently been promoted to CEO. He was not the CEO during the time that OxyContin was developed and promoted. That person was a Sackler family member. But they escaped totally untouched by that settlement.
Wow. So,
And in the media, you know, nobody ever, the word Sackler came up nowhere. You know, and there's a lot of media about the settlement at the time. It was a really big deal. They actually had hearings in the United States Senate about whether the punishment was, you know, too light on the executives, and barely anybody, it was really just one person who was the mother of a victim, ever mentioned the word Sackler.
Does anybody ever refer to that CEO as the fall guy?
Well, you know, he did play an important role at the company. He had been the head of marketing before he became the CEO. But, you know, and I kind of asked people, you know, employees who had worked at the company, if they thought that this guy was really taking the fall for Richard Sackler, who was the president of the company, you know, people did not really seem to be of that opinion. You know, they thought that Friedman, you know, was quite involved in stuff, and, you know, and then Sackler maybe was involved also. But I think that the Sacklers were generally more popular among the employees than these executives were.
It's nice if you can pay the bonuses. And we should say that the fines that Purdue paid represent, like, relatively, like, what? Like, you know, upgrading the desserts in the commissary or something? I mean, relative to their profits?
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe like, they've made, you know, $35 billion in revenue from OxyContin. So you compare, you know, $600 million and change to $35 billion. You know, it doesn't seem like that much, a couple percent.
So where does all this stand now? I mean, are they, the Sacklers are getting a little bit of attention now, nothing relative to the havoc that has been, and the sheer suffering and death, frankly, that their product has created in this country. Like, where is all of this now?
Well, their company is in really big trouble in the United States, and there have been dozens and dozens of lawsuits filed by cities, counties, states, and the trajectory of this is, it looks very similar right now to what happened with the tobacco litigation in the late 90s. You know, and under that settlement, the master settlement for big tobacco, companies had to pay more than $200 billion. So, I mean, it's really a massive, massive thing. So a lot of people think that this is trending in that direction, that, you know, so many lawsuits are being filed against Purdue in so many jurisdictions that they're going to have to settle. Like, the game theory of it is such that they really cannot afford to litigate all these things individually, even if they thought they would win, which is not at all clear. So the company is in really big trouble, but the Sacklers have all these international companies also, and that's where the real growth opportunity is now. So, you know, OxyContin is kind of, you know, on the wane in the United States, and the CDC last year issued these very restrictive guidelines, basically suggesting that people not prescribe opioids for chronic pain at all. So the United States market is waning, but other countries have not had prescription drug epidemics yet. So, you know, other countries, the United States still consumes a hugely disproportionate share of the world's opioids. Canada does also, it should be said. But the company, so the Sacklers now, their companies are on the march in Brazil, in Colombia, in China, and that this is, they're trying to make up for the shortfall in the American market by going abroad. And this is a strategy also quite reminiscent of what Big Tobacco did
right
after the late 90s when, you know, they're running into all this regulatory trouble in the United States. So what do you do in that case? That's when you go abroad.
And are there, I mean, you know, with tobacco, I could see how it would have been super easy for the tobacco companies to begin to do this abroad. But is there not any protections for those? I mean, are there not entities in these other countries that are saying like, wow, here comes this tidal wave. We just saw it wipe out an enormous amount of lives in the United States. It's just not the same mechanisms or what?
Well, so, I mean, that's an interesting question. Most countries have much weaker regulatory regimes in general than the United States does, and not the same kind of restrictions on various kinds of advertising. Although pharmaceutical advertising is kind of a special case, and the United States actually has an unusually liberal pharmaceutical advertising regime. Also, most countries, have a socialized healthcare system. So, if you're talking about the government, and is the government really going to pay, in Brazil or in European countries to get the whole country hooked on opioids, then that can be kind of a tall order. So, the United States, is generally the most profitable market for pharmaceutical manufacturers, and there are some barriers in terms of distribution in other places, but if you're willing to go around the system, if you want to sell pain pills outside the socialized system in countries like Brazil and Colombia, then that presents some opportunities.
Chris Glazek, the piece is The Secret of Family Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.